Hi, I'm Ray Reagans.
And I'm Ezra Zuckerman Sivan. And this is Outsider
Insider. Okay. Ezra, good morning.
Good morning, Ray. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
So we got to tell people who we are. A lot of pressure, right? We're both sociologists.
I know we're both sociologists.
Yes.
Business
Here
school
at MIT,
professors. MIT.
Sloan School of Management.
Ezra's a Yankees fan.
Yeah. We like to say Yankee fan, I got to say.
Yankee.
It's not Yankees Stadium, is it?
It's Yankee Stadium.
There we go.
And I'm a Steelers fan. Pittsburgh Steelers. My whole life.
Yeah, luckily the Yankees and Steelers don't play each other. Different sports, folks.
Different sports.
Right.
Right. And, you know, we've known each other for more than 30 years.
30 years. Brings back memories. We can go down memory lane, Ray.
We won't.
Right. So me, I'm a Jewish guy originally from Providence, Rhode Island.
I'm a black guy from Wichita, Kansas, left home for the first time to go to Providence, Rhode Island.
That's true. There's a great story in that.
There's an underlying theme to the work that we do. Social identities.
Yep.
And the role that social identities can play and how people learn from each other, the likelihood of them being connected. So there's just a lot of ways that identity influences, you know, dynamics that we're seeing in the world.
Well said, Ray.
Thank you, Ezra. Every once in a while.
So this particular episode is prompted by the set of challenges that we faced after October 7th, 2023.
Yeah.
Vicious attack by Hamas on southern Israel outside of Gaza. That led to all kinds of reactions around the world, including right here on MIT campus.
Right.
But many of our episodes won't have anything to do with that, or we won't talk about it explicitly. But what we'll have in common are the set of challenges that we're talking about.
Right. It's just the start.
Yep.
Can I continue to set that moment to fall?
Please.
Hamas attacks Israel on October 7th.
Yep.
Over a two-week interval. The devastating impact of this attack was just hard for me to believe. The number of people who were murdered, the atrocities happening at the concert, the number of hostages that were taking into Gaza.
Yeah, deeply emotionally traumatic. The kinds of things that make you cry, make you want to do something. Say nothing of the ongoing war, the mass civilian suffering in Gaza, the lives lost. And we know how much it's affected our students and, not surprisingly, you know, has mobilized them.
Right. What struck me, there were several things that struck me, but what struck me in particular was just the amount of activity on campus.
Yeah.
In many ways, people said it reminded them of the activity they saw on campus in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
The loud voices, people voicing their opinions very strongly. There was the protest in the lobby.
Yeah.
There was the protest out in front. There were some attempts to enter faculty classrooms.
Yep. If you were in the dorms.
This is where I was going to go.
Yeah.
If you were in a dorm.
Right. You couldn't escape it.
Which side are you on? Pressured to choose.
A lot of pressure to take a side. Yeah.
Right.
This is what we're hearing.
This is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
But what struck me was how many people were also alone. The sense of loneliness that was felt on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of silence.
Right. I mean, let's be clear. Whether it's the initial attack, the invasion and the atrocities associated with that in southern Israel, whether it's Israel's counterattack and the mass starvation, civilian deaths, it's just too much for us to really do justice to here. So we're going to be zooming in to the MIT campus. And this feeling that students on each side, and I hate using the word side, I know you do too, Ray, where I'm devastated, I'm in pain for an obvious reason. And how can it be that people around me don't get that? People who care about me.
There it is. I mean, that's what we're talking about, that type of isolation.
Yep. When people who you think should care or do care, you think that they can see your pain, but all you get is silence, you start to think, oh, they don't actually care about me. Right?
It's a good inference to draw.
Right. And a lot of people I was talking to really did seem to be bewildered by that lack of reaching out. it was like, hey, how come people aren't saying to me, hey, I saw the news, I know you're Jewish, or I know you're Arab, how are you doing with it?
Right.
And this is a version of a general problem.
A general problem.
Yep.
You're in pain, and the people who you know care about you somehow don't reach out.
Right.
So today, we decided to focus in on the Jewish perspective.
Yep.
And we did that because you're Jewish.
Right. I'm Jewish, and I've got family, friends in Israel. I spent a lot of time there over the years. Strong connection.
Right.
So we're going to start there.
But we know there's the Palestinian perspective, there's the Muslim perspective, there's the Arab perspective. And so in future episodes, we want to bring those perspectives in.
Exactly. Well said, Ray. So after October 7th, what I'm feeling myself personally, right, is no shortage of friends, colleagues who did reach out to me in various kinds of ways. People who know I'm Jewish, and I'm pretty public about that. You know, my connection to Israel, people know that I was on sabbatical there for a year and have family there and all that. But even me, I notice it's kind of interesting. Like there's some people who I really would have expected would reach out and didn't. And what I know is these are people who do care about me.
Yes.
And so I know there's something else going on that's, it can't be that these people are bigoted in some way towards me. I know that's not true. I know these people very well.
These are literally your people.
My people, yes. People I'm very, very close to.
Right.
And weren't necessarily reaching out. I knew that the most, or I felt in my bones somehow, that yes, there is animus, yes, there is hatred, but that's not everything that was going on. And what we do is, as social scientists, right, is we try to, we never want to assume there's just one cause. We want to try to break it down, right?
Can I say it a different way?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
You're in a good position of having strong, positive, supportive relationships with people.
I would say blessed with that, yep.
So you knew it had to be something else. It
had to be something else.
Okay.
And so I'm puzzling over this as we're doing a million things, Ray, and trying to address the situation, right? But in the midst of all that, something clicks in my mind, which is this conversation that you and I had, Ray.
What was the conversation?
Well, it was back maybe 6 months earlier. And you said something that at the time I thought, when I first heard it, was like bonkers and wrong.
And that wouldn't be surprising. I'm often saying things that are bonkers and wrong.
And it was about me, right? Effectively, right? Right? And I thought when he first said it, I'm like, that is dead wrong. So we should tell people what it is, right? Right?
I think we should.
Okay. So.
So we're in a seminar.
Yep. So a research seminar.
Research seminar. Right. Ezra and some of his colleagues. Maybe I said this because I was a little jealous. He's doing research with other people. And they're presenting this work on the role of the nuclear family in the Jewish community. Mother, father, children.
Right.
That's the organizing unit.
Yeah. And basically about like socialization of like how Jewish kids, teenagers in this case, like are affected by their upbringing
in
their family. Right. There's a stereotype about Jews, which I think is a little bit in that paper. Right.
And I'm sitting there. Let's just assume this is HBO. My bullshit meter is going off. They're talking about family. I have to tell you, I think the thing that set me off was this image, this role of the Jewish mother in the socialization of the children. It was like 1950s Leave It to Beaver.
Right.
That's exactly the image that this paper was painting. And that you'd have a heightened version of that in the Jewish community. And I say to Ezra, I can't imagine a group of people for whom family matters less.
Less, Ray?
Less. That's how I said it to you.
So when I tell this story to people, what you said, and I almost always tell it to fellow Jews like me, everyone is different in various kinds of ways, but they're going to say, what? You meant the opposite, right?
Right.
So when Ray said that, I thought, I did a double take. I'm like, what? And then I asked him about it, and I don't remember exactly what you said then, but I thought, huh, Ray is onto something super, super, super interesting.
You know, it's funny, getting ready for this, I had asked myself, why did I think that family wasn't important?
Right.
Even as I say it out loud now, it's a little surprising. And it was just based on a feeling that I had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I spent a lot of time in Squirrel Hill, which is a Jewish community. My daughter plays baseball for the Little League team.
Yep.
My son worked the baseball field.
Right. And I knew a lot of this before because I knew where you were coming from.
You knew where I was right. coming from. And so why did I feel that this image of the nuclear family was wrong? It didn't line up with what I was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see mom, dad, kids isolated. I saw intermingling, intermixing, everyone seeming to be concerned for a set of kids that weren't simply their kids. And you know, I compare that to me. I was concerned with my son. The other kids, they were there, but they were scenery for me. My son was the focus of my attention. So when I contrasted my family with the Jewish families, the behaviors felt different, right? It was more expansive. That's the word I'll use.
Didn't matter that much to them if it was their kid or someone else's
kid. It didn't
kid.
Matter as exactly.
So what Ray said, right, was I've never met people, meaning Jewish people, for whom family is less important. Here's what I now think about Ray's insight and why I think it's a really, really deep insight. And it goes like this.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And then it's going to come back to you at some point.
If you insist.
Yeah, I would insist. All right. Yeah. So one thing that's really challenging here is that every group is very, very heterogeneous. There are all kinds of Jews. There's American Jews, there's Israelis, all kinds of American Jews. The majority of American Jews are like me in that we basically came to America somewhere between 1880 and 1922 from Eastern Europe. And if you ask typical American Jews, especially of a background like mine, hey, how did you get to this country? Where did you come from? Right? Where your ancestors from? Well, people will basically give you an answer that is, I think, familiar to a lot of Americans and people around the world in one way or another through the musical Fiddler on the Roof.
I have to tell you, I've never seen it. And so help me.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I'm pretty sure almost every American Jewish family has seen Fiddler on the Roof, right? Which was originally a Broadway show in the 60s. And I do remember as a kid in the 80s, it was re-released. And I remember everybody went to see it. So Fiddler on the Roof is, it's based on the works of the most influential Jewish author of the late 19th century, early 20th century. He's actually great-great-uncle, something like that, of my wife's. It was a big star. His name was Shalom Aleichem. And the play Fiddler on the Roof was based on one of his short stories. And it described village life in these small towns, these shtetlach, in Eastern Europe. And it painted a scene of life in one of these towns. And the vast majority of the people who lived in the town were Jews. And it describes a period of transition. Political troubles are coming, especially in the Russian Empire. And this was a period in which there were pogroms. So a pogrom was a term, a Russian term, for massacre, and particularly massacres of Jews. And that was a big part of what pushed so many to emigrate, you know, as refugees to the United States. In particular, and that's where the vast majority of American Jews, called Ashkenazi, originate from. So the scene in these villages that's painted by Fiddler on the Roof is kind of a pre-modern scene. There's a different tradesmen. So there's the butcher, the tailor, there's the rabbis. It wasn't a glamorous world, basically a life of poverty. They were just making it by, but they were all guided by a set of customs that were centuries old. You know, there's a famous song, right, which is tradition.
You know, I think I might be familiar with the song
yeah.
if you tried to sing some of it.
All day long. Tradition. But the, you know, what's trying to convey is there was kind of a rhythm to life in the shtetl that was kind of this very self-contained Jewish world. And that Fiddler on the Roof kind of like both reflected that kind of like memory that people had and also reinforced it, like had an effect on people. And I think when American Jews kind of in one way or another hearken back, they can feel very strongly connected to that. That's like my people. Those are my people. And by the way, people who came to America in that period, right, were here during World War II. But most people stayed. Right. And those are the same people who were, for the most part, exterminated by the Nazis. Right. Or became refugees. They were survivors of the Holocaust. And when people kind of think about the Holocaust American Jews do, who came, you know, from my background, from before that, they will feel very strongly connected to that experience, too, because those are our people, even though you might not know any of those people and you may have lost contact.
Right.
And by the way, that's true, I think, more generally in Jewish history. Part of Jewish culture is to remember different moments in Jewish history. There's holidays for this. People may be familiar with the holiday of Passover, which is celebrated every spring. The heart of that ritual is a retelling of the story in a certain kind of stylized way of the biblical Exodus. And it's explicit in the text that you read, which is that it is required for every Jew who's at the Seder to see themselves as if they left Egypt, meaning they were part of the Exodus. And there are all kinds of events like that in Jewish history of persecution and oppression. And those kinds of things kind of encourage this kind of strong identification with experiences that happen to members of the Jewish people.
Right.
So if you think about Christian holidays, they're much more about the life, the death, the resurrection, and maybe the message, the teachings of Jesus, but not about, say, the Christian people as a people in the same way. It's just a different kind of shade of emphasis. But the point I'm making is there's something distinctive, I think, about Jewish memory. I can put a book about this in the show notes if we have that.
Right. So the Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah.
The Jewish holidays. What you want me to take away from that is that there's something distinct.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's overlap with other traditions, but that is distinctive in the Jewish tradition. There's a long way of getting back to Ray's observation. And Ray's just listening patiently because he knows that I get to be really long-winded, right? And
that's actually not true. I actually wanted to hear a little bit more from you in that moment, but I'll take all what
right,
you
right.
gave us.
Well, you don't encourage me too much, but keep on going on and on. But what's important, I think, in all of that, what I realized, and thinking back to like Ray's insight, is Jews in general, American Jews, can identify very, very strongly with other Jews in these different moments in history. Through the present moment, can feel very, very strongly connection to them, identify with them. When something happens to those other people, it's like something happened to them, even though they're not members of their family. They're not blood relations in any way. And it occurs to me, Ray, that if we think about the most common prayer that's been said in Jewish communities throughout the world since October 7th, it's a prayer for the release of hostages. It starts off by saying, our brothers, all of Israel, those who are in distress or in bondage, and then it continues to pray for their release. And what's important is it uses the word brothers, but it doesn't mean literal brothers.
Yeah.
And so what I came to realize, or let's say it's an hypothesis, that what Ray was putting his finger on was something really, really interesting, which is that in a way, family is not actually that important, right? What's more important, at least in relative terms, what's more important, right, for creating kind of this sense of like connection, and identification and like caring and happiness when really good things happen, but also pain when really awful things happen, is this sense of peoplehood. We're a member of the same people. Like looking back at the shtetl or participating in holidays, it may be with your family that you're doing this, like holidays in particular, but it's you know, all these different families in parallel or in together doing something.
That's amazing.
That relates to that sort of transcends those individual families.
It's a multiverse in a sense. So I'm doing it with my families.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about all the families that came before me. Does it have an element of thinking about the families that might come after me?
Sure, of course. It's very intergenerational that way, yeah.
That's fine. I find that fascinating.
Ray, as we've been talking about this, it's tricky, right? Because there's a very, very subtle point that we're trying to make here, right? Which is that, you know, it's not that family is not important, right? For you know, Eastern European American Jews or for any, you know, for Jews in general, whatever it is, right? It's that maybe the emphasis more is on peoplehood rather than nuclear family in particular, right? Or even maybe extended kinship network, right? And so this is related a little bit to the notion that the anthropologists coined, which is of fictive kin, right? That I and someone else who's, you know, a fellow Jew, right, might sort of in some sense be a member of the same family.
That's my family, but not like my family.
Right.
But important to me. And so what happens to them is relevant for me.
Yeah. It is me somehow.
It is me.
Right.
And I was going to say, I had zero insight into that, mm-hmm. but the behavior I saw when I made my comment
right.
about family being less important.
Yeah.
Right? I had in mind a certain idea of family.
The nuclear family.
The idea of a nuclear family is not the idea of family that is held by this group.
Right. Right. And I'm like, oh, that, I get it now. And basically, I think that one reason in the days after that, the Hamas massacre, that people who, even though they cared about Jews who were in pain, and maybe we're familiar, you know, we're aware that something really terrible had happened to Israeli Jews, and by the way, some you know non-Jews also in southern Israel around the border of Gaza, what's known as the Gaza envelope. They didn't make the connection it had anything to do with these people, right, or much to do with them, because they didn't have this idea of Jewish peoplehood,
right.
So good examples of that. We have a colleague. Started to talk about this stuff, and he tells me, yeah, my wife, so he's the colleague is Jewish, his wife is Jewish. My wife had to fire her therapist. And I'm like, why? She said, well, she was in great distress after the October 7th, his wife was, and she talked about that with her therapist. And the therapist responded in a way that she perceived was kind of cold and unfeeling. She said, well, these are not actually members of your family. And she was shocked because, like, how could she not get how this affected her?
Not your family.
Right, right. But if you don't have kind of this notion that these are members of the same people and who kind of think of themselves, even though they're not family, like family, right, then you may not get it. You're not going to get that's connected, right? So then we went back to, you know, you and I together talking this through, working out, right, which is what we would call like theory development. We won't get too highfalutin about it, but working out, how is it possible that people aren't reaching out to me? Maybe it's because there's like a disconnect there of what sort of like how Jews, American Jews in particular, how they see themselves and how other people see them. That creates kind of an invisibility.
There it is.
Right?
And something I can't like believe that, right? that you don't see me at this moment.
Right. On the other hand, one thing that we began to hear, another set of things that we started to hear about all kinds of stories was about self-discovery.
Yes.
So where there were, I know many stories like this. Some of this got reported in the media of American Jews who were surprised themselves to discover that this event affected them in the way that it did, that it caused the pain that it did, that it mobilized them in some way to want to help out in some way. And then they felt alone when no one reached out to them. But they should maybe be not so surprised that it was unintelligible, right, or difficult to understand what their connection to this event was. When they themselves, if you had told them on October 6th, you know, if you'd ask them how are they going to react on October 7th when they hear this, if they were to hear this, they would not have been able to predict how they were going to reach out.
They would have asked you, what are you talking about?
Right. They might have said, hey, this is what's going to happen. And someone's going to reach out to you and say, oh, are you Jewish? Because we want to support you or something like that. And they might have said, like, you know, what? Like, that's not a thing. You don't reach out to me like that. Like, why is my Jewishness relevant to you? Like, don't treat me like a member of a category.
Right.
Just like, so that's a hard problem. Right. So it's unintelligible, not just to people around you, but even to yourself in some way.
Yeah. But it's this, I want you to see the dynamic of a group for whom something is now important to them because something has happened in the world.
Right. What we're talking about here is now all of a sudden, you know, the ground shifts really quickly and the meaning of what it means to be Jewish in this case becomes all of a sudden more important, more salient.
Not only
in
more
some way,
important.
Right?
But it actually becomes right. a moment where we can begin to sort through what the idea of being Jewish really means.
Right. And we could say the same thing also, what it means to be black isn't static either.
It's not static.
It's not always the same thing. It can change based on like crises like we're talking about, right? Hopefully good things too.
Right.
Right. So Ray, I don't think if we hadn't had that conversation back in the spring, it would have clicked for me that one piece of what's going on, not the whole piece, but a really important piece is that this sense of peoplehood, right? That even though they're not blood relations, right? And they're another part of the world, that they somehow are me, right? That's one piece of it.
Okay. So now I get it. And so here's the fact. We know that people didn't reach out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're offering an explanation that's based on peoplehood mm-hmm. for Jews.
Right, right.
There are other reasons why I might still be reluctant to reach out.
Right. I'm going to be a little nervous here because we're scientists. We're social scientists. And we get nervous whenever we talk about things like we don't actually have hard data about this. I haven't done this survey. So this is just a little bit me, you know, here's what I think is true. As a sociologist and coming from this background.
And one of the reasons we're saying it out loud is we want people to help us.
Oh, totally. We want to hear feedback.
Yeah. We're open to the fact, the possibility of being wrong.
Yep. We expect to be wrong, right? At least correctably wrong.
But we know there are other explanations for why people didn't reach out. And we're going to start to talk about those right now. One of them is, I don't want to offend someone.
Yeah, what do you have in mind?
So just assume, I know it's relevant for you. I think you're hurting. But what would I say in that situation? You know, if I say, mm-hmm. Ezra, I see that there's this horrific tragedy in Israel right now. Right. Are you doing okay?
Yeah, I might say, does Ray think that I'm Israeli or like I'm not really American or something
might
like that?
Might signal that I think you're foreign.
Right. Dual loyalty.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Because like you don't want to say to your friend, "Oh, I guess you're really not American. You're really Israeli." When it comes down to it, or something like that. That is a very sensitive topic. So people should have in mind this issue comes up around Asianness in particular, right? Similar kind of thing.
Right. We know that Asian Americans experience this. Mm-hmm, like when people say, "You speak so well. Where are you from originally?"
Right.
I'm from California.
Right, because the assumption is, even though, like, you could be, you know, multiple generations in this country, somehow you're still not American.
You're still not American.
Right. So same thing, you know, if you assume somebody, because they're Jewish, that they somehow are connected to another country.
It's in the identity. Jewish-American, Asian-American, not American, right? Which implies that maybe mm-hmm. your loyalty.
Right.
You know, lie somewhere else.
Yeah. So people might be reluctant to reach out for that reason. And there's another one, right? Which is, you know, if you're somebody like, you know, who is not public with your Jewishness, right? It may be that I know that you're Jewish and maybe that you're, maybe even know that you're affected, but do you actually want me to recognize that, to like call that out if you haven't, you know, all this time, not even really discussed your Jewishness with other people, with anything like that? It's a pretty sensitive thing to call somebody else's identity out into the open when it's not out there, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's another reason why people are afraid to reach out, and it was happening in the student dorms. They were afraid that if they reached out to one side, that they were picking sides.
Right, right, right.
And so supporting you meant that I had to give up relationships with my friends on the other side.
Yeah, and I think the natural tendency, especially like you were saying, Ray, when you've got ties on both sides— is that people just like, okay, I don't want to take sides. Yeah? And so you withdraw.
Yeah, I'll use myself as an example. So we have lunches, community lunches,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a lunch for Jewish or Israeli faculty and students.
Yeah.
There's a lunch for, you know, Arab and Muslim faculty and students.
Yep.
And there's the one that I like. Is it the third way?
I think we'd say third space. But
the
third space. Yeah, yeah.
And so I got invited to, you know, the Jewish-Israeli lunch in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no problem going, right? This is early in the conflict.
Yep.
I got invited today, and I actually spent a moment thinking, what inferences will people draw if they see me at this lunch?
Right, I see. That you're taking sides.
That I've taken sides.
Right.
But I have a reputation for not taking a side.
Right.
And now I'm at this lunch.
Mm-hmm.
I went anyway. But I did think for a moment, what will other people think?
Right.
Ezra, we run the risk, as we describe reasons for why people didn't reach out,
right,
of excusing it. That's not what we're trying to do here.
No.
We're trying to empower people to reach out despite those risks.
Right. I think we're trying to get people to be a little more patient with each other and to, like, maybe increase your willingness to try, even in a very fraught situation where there is some possibility that you might end up offending somebody. But
you still should try.
Right. And we don't want to say there isn't actual bigotry out there, right? There isn't animus. That stuff is real. But we also know that there's cases where you know, the fear that could be what's going on could lead people to think there's more of that than there is.
And that's the bigger problem. Is if you do nothing, the negative inferences that people are going to be drawing.
You can get reinforced, yeah.
They're going to be reinforced.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's time for me to come clean.
I'm not sure what you mean.
I mean, here we are talking about the challenges that people faced, explanations for why people didn't reach out, would suggest that we have a better sense for what they should do. Because I having this conversation.
Yeah.
And I went back and I looked at the text. Like, of course I had been in contact with Ezra on October 7th. Actually, I didn't. I waited until the 8th.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the 2-day Jewish holiday on the 7th and 8th. And Ray knows me so well, right, that he knows that I'm not even online. Right.
Right. Right.
Right,
and
right.
So I waited.
Until then. Right. Right.
But then I look back. And so we're talking.
Yeah.
Lots of communication, even on the phone. But I look back because we have the record, the text.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at my text to Ezra. And the thing that I notice is, can I use the word wonky?
Wonk as in like policy
wonk?
Yeah,
like policy wonk.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They're very wonky.
Yeah.
Right? What is Hamas thinking? Wait a minute, these meetings between Iran and Hamas, doesn't that happen all the time? Is there really any information in that?
Interesting, yeah.
Why wasn't the IDF paying more attention to this information that they were getting?
Yeah.
That's the conversation we were having.
Right.
I mean, those are the things that kind of questions I'm asking Ezra, and he's responding to me.
Yeah.
It's very clinical, it's analytical.
And yeah. Back then.
Right. Because I hadn't really internalized what this meant to him on a personal level.
Right.
And it took me a minute to see, and I see it more clearly now, that it had affected him in a personal way that I didn't understand, that I hadn't even anticipated.
Right. And I never even thought about it because it's the context of the relationship.
Right. You wouldn't have expected me to be different, but I should have been different.
Maybe. Put it this way. When I went to summer camp and I was a kid, my late father, the way, you know, what was in the postcards, back then we had postcards we'd send to each other, was about, like, what was happening in Yankee games over the week. It was the way that he communicated. I mean, we also talked, you know, he was a very loving father, but it was just the language. It was like, you know, people talk about love languages today, right? It was like our love language. That's how I interpreted it, Ray, was I think you're talking to me, like, even the fact that you're thinking about this and it's actually taken up headspace and emotional space for you making sense of it, that actually communicated something to me without you having to say anything. I didn't think I thought much about that.
Okay. So we're still good then?
We're more than good.
So I don't have to do any more of these?
I dragged you into this, right? And you're here.
I was doing this to make up for that. I thought I had failed you there, so I was making up for it here. So I don't have to do any more of these?
No. You haven't made up for me yet.
Okay. All right.
We got more to do.
All right.
Let me say this. I think we got to share something with everybody.
Okay.
You can imagine a lot of scenarios in which, you know, someone says to me, hey, I never met people for whom family is less important, meaning Jews. And they said that to me. And I'm like, what the hell are you? And not take them seriously.
Right.
Not listen to them. Not hear what they have to say, that they have insight and perspective about me. Right?
Right.
When we started talking about what I learned from you, we started to hear from back to other people, like, how is that possible? For this Jewish guy to learn from this black guy about, like, what it means to be a Jew. Right?
I had to hold back my response on that, but I'll go ahead, right? We've been describing a process.
Right.
Where there's this moment.
Right.
There's a shock. It's precisely during that moment when someone at the edge of that group, perhaps just outside that group,
yeah,
could offer something useful.
You're thinking Georg Zimmel, aren't you, Ray?
I'm thinking Zimmel.
Yeah.
And so what would Zimmel tell us about this situation?
All right. So Georg Zimmel, turn of the 20th century German sociologist. And he has this essay about the stranger. And he's talking about groups in history that were very much intimately connected to the life of a community, but were outsiders, were not really allowed in, actually, into that community, were just defined as being outsiders. And the example that he gives is Jews in medieval and early modern Europe. So Zimmel first points this out, right, which is that it's possible sometimes for someone who is not an insider to actually have better perspective, a little more objective, actually, right, than an insider, right? That they can be more neutral. Often people confide in them, right? So it reminds me, the great sociologist Irving Goffman has a discussion that's related to this. He talks about the helping professions is the term that he uses. So you're talking about barbers, right? Everyone knows barbers are, you know, I think the Black community is famous for this, right, as places you go to, like, gossip.
And the
right?
barbershop was my church. I've heard you talk about religion a lot.
There you go.
I think of the Black barber.
Right, okay, yeah. And some people might think of a bartender this way, right? So you are, because you are an outsider, you actually are then seem to be something somewhat more neutral and objective. In some ways, the tools that we have as sociologists allow us to be a little bit of an outsider-insider in any kind of social scene that we're trying to figure out.
Yes, because we're not just talking about this particular conflict.
No, and we're not even talking about conflicts in general.
Listen, I think that ultimately this is a podcast that's about, maybe you want to call it family, maybe you want to call it inclusion. It's the challenges of being part, you know, of a diverse community and really trying to gain some insight and understand, right? What motivates, what drives, what's affecting different members of that community.
Mm.
And can I share with you the thing that you prompted me to learn?
I hope
about my identity?
Yeah, yeah.
You encouraged me to go think about Black family reunions. And I have to admit to thinking it wasn't interesting. And it turns out it was fascinating.
Yeah. And that came from me noticing something that is different about the Black family from what I'm familiar with, the American Jewish family.
Right.
Put it this way. I feel blessed by our relationship and the tools that we have. You know, as sociologists, even though we got to be super humble about, like, our limits of what we can do.
Yeah.
We didn't grow up the same, you know, the same part of the country, same part of the track, same kind of background. But we're able, because of who we are together, to produce some things that we think other people can also produce on their own even, right? If they can build the kinds of relationships that we have around commonality and difference, both, right?
You can't wait to build these relationships when you need them.
Mm. Yeah.
And you can't be building these relationships thinking that you're building them because you need them.
Well said. Yeah.
You just need to be building these relationships because they're good.
Aw.
I'm Ray Reagans.
I'm Ezra Zuckerman-Sivan.
You've been listening to
Outsider
Insider, a podcast from MIT.
We want to give special thanks to the MIT Sloan School of Management, Office of the Dean, Office of Communications, and Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for their time and support of this podcast. Special shout out to the executive producer,
Kate O'Sullivan. This episode was produced and edited by the awesome
Nora CB, Sheena Ozaki, and Pete Langston. Recording by Chris McDonald.
Thank you, Chris.
I want to just add special thanks.
Go ahead.
To a whole bunch of colleagues, students, and others with whom we've shared ideas that led to this podcast.
You know, I think we're thanking them in advance of their support and help because there's going to be many more people involved.
Right. And this is a good opportunity to say that we are working on figuring out the right platform for sharing the background ideas, you know, the research and the research in progress that supports what we're developing here and also gives folks an opportunity to share their feedback that we can incorporate to future episodes.
I hope you don't mind if I share my first experience, my first introduction. to an element of Jewish culture.
Okay. Oh, at Brown?
At Brown.
Oh, my gosh. One of my favorite stories. You want to tell that story?
I'm going to tell it.
All right, go
ahead. So I'm at Brown. I'm from Wichita, Kansas. You know, Brown gives you this thing, this card. You can spend it for snacks at
night.
All right,
wait, we got to say 1986.
1987.
Yeah.
1987.
Okay, long time ago.
Yeah. 1987.
I was a senior in high school.
I'm looking for snacks. Because at Brown, you have this meal card. You can get snacks all across campus at different hours of the night.
Right. You never have been on the East Coast before. Northeast, right?
I traveled to Oklahoma because my family's from Oklahoma. Right?
And let's just say this is a wider space.
It's a little wider. And so I go to buy these snacks and I find these donuts.
Yeah.
And I say to my friend who's there with me, I say, these
wait, are... Wait. So you said, can I set the scene a little more?
Please.
When you
set
tell the story,
scene.
I always say, so you come to town, and this is very natural.
Yes.
You basically gravitate to other black students.
That's right.
And you're basically kind of like forming a group.
Making our way through Brown
and
together.
Because you got something in common with them and you're joining together. And what I remember the story is that maybe you're acting out your blackness a little more than you might otherwise together.
Are we saying that live on radio?
Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Maybe.
All right. Fair enough. Good. Yeah. All right. Good. Yeah.
Wow. maybe that was true. But here's the important part. The important part, yes, actually, we were being a little loud.
Oh, there we go. Good. All right. Good. Yep.
And we were being loud about the fact that here they are serving these stale donuts.
What I remember was something like, damn, these are the stalest donuts I've ever seen, right?
In my life. They weren't donuts, people. They were bagels.
Right. And what people probably don't know because we're freaking old is that even in Providence, I remember when the first bagel store showed up in Providence, not that long before, 1980. And so bagels, which were people then associated with like a Jewish food out of New York, right, was unknown. Certainly wasn't even known in Providence.
Think about that.
Right. Maybe until 1980.
Thank you for
but certainly in Wichita,
my ignorance.
Right. So even white folks in Wichita would not know what a bagel was, right?
It was a stale donut. So it's not like I have special insight into this community.
Yeah, but you've learned a lot.
I've learned a lot.
Yeah.